intriguing, and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, The Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Tell you a little bit about Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
It's great. In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant?
Dare to think out loud.
You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded.
Dare to think out loud.
You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren.
Dare to think out loud.
You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history.
Dare to think out loud.
You have tuned in to the right show.
Dare to think out loud.
Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Well, dare to think out loud. Here we are on the fourth day of June in the year of 2021. And I'm here with my good friend Cal Robbins from out there in sunny Arizona, and our good friend and producer Dave Scorpio from down south of the border. South of the equator. And Dave will not be with us except for the first hour. He's got some important stuff to take care of. So I want him to start off by telling folks about his program tomorrow and about how that you folks out there can help us keep this clarion for rightful liberty alive on. And actually, all of the hosts being able to present their message in free speech. So, Dave, help us out, my friend.
Sure, Mike. This is great. My show comes on, you know, tomorrow from 1 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio A. And my guest will be E. Michael Jones. And we're going to talk about some current events and also his absolutely fascinating book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. Which is, you know, an over 1,000-page book of history that is quite fascinating. And, you know, in terms of helping the station, you know, everyone's well aware that free speech is under attack from all sides right now. It's getting to the point where anything that contradicts the official government narrative is becoming verboten. So everyone come on freedomslips.com. That's freedomslips.com. or revolution.radio, and you'll see a Patreon button. Go on there and just donate what you can, and, you know, try to do it every month because it takes money to keep the station going, and nobody is actually being paid. The management is not being paid. The tech people aren't being paid, and neither are the hosts. So keep that in mind. Everyone's doing this to try to help keep humanity free. And also, you can scroll down to the bottom of the front page, and there's a physical address where you can mail in money the old-fashioned way.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate that. Let me take care of a little bit of housekeeping here, too. For those of you who happen to be on Telegram, I would ask you to join my channel, The Rebel Madman, where I publish items on the Constitution on a regular basis, along with some dynamite memes to further accentuate our argument, our point of view. And then Sunday afternoon or evening, whichever one it happens to be, at 6 o'clock Eastern time, on my program, Addicted to Our Own Destruction, or Addicted to Your Own Destruction, DW and I will be having Paul English of Eurofolk Radio on with us, and we're going to delve into banking and money, which is a key issue because everything having to do with government is about money. It's about revenue. It's about collecting money, forcibly collecting money. But how did all of this get started, and are there any examples to where this people have come up with an equitable arrangement for money to where the people aren't taxed to death to pay interest on a loan where money is created out of nothing? And then again, this time next week, we will have, DW will join Cal and I, and we will have the Reverend Ted Weiland on, and we will be discussing during this same time slot, is the Constitution a Christian document? So, hope you will be able to join us for all of those. And again, tune in on Telegram to Rebel Madman channel. Thank you. But I do have a website called rebelmadman.com, so the slip there is has some justification. But speaking of that, let's have our friend Cal from out there in sunny Arizona. Cal, how you doing, my friend?
Doing good. Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Dave. It's getting warm out here in sunny Arizona. We're hitting up into the 110s, 111 degrees for the last 3 days. So it's summer's found its way here already.
Ooh, and I saw the pictures of your nice crop of vegetables. I'm envious, my friend.
Yeah, yesterday was a good day of vegetables out of the garden.
Oh, super. Well, and our friend Dave Scorpio there is making a move in the future, and I think that's one of the reasons he has to jump off for the second hour for us, is to jump out there and to get some work done so he can get here before he has to be jabbed to do the trick. Is that not true, Dave?
That's exactly right, Mike. You nailed it 100%. And, you know, that sounds like a fascinating lineup you have, you know, and this discussion about banking with Paul English is going to be fantastic, because really, if you think about it, central banking as we know it is nothing more than organized and legalized criminality, and it's the root of so many problems that we face in this world.
Oh, it may be the root of all of them.
Yes, I think you're right.
COVID BS has its roots in money. Almost everything that government does is rooted in money, and that would mean that the COVID and the vaccine are rooted in money. And one of the things we know for sure is if you want to have more of the money, you have to have fewer people. That being said, Dave, any comment on that?
I think you're exactly right. It is the root of all the problems, and it's the ability to print money out of nothing and then essentially hand it out to your friends through various covert methods that the public's not aware of. And you can get any project done that you want, including designing some kind of virus, that's weaponized in some way, and then spreading fear through the media, and then convincing the entire world that every person in the world should take the same shot. You couldn't do it without central banking, Mike.
Oh, that's for sure. And let's go back to William Paterson, 1694, when he created the Bank of England, his famous comment, "We will be able to realize money, realized profit created from interest on money we create out of nothing.
Yes, and of course, you know, the other key factor in the creation of the Bank of England was that it was money to fund a war. That was the sort of the genesis for it. So war and central banking are also intertwined and cannot be separated.
Well, thank you for that lead in to today's program, Dave. You nailed it. Thank you. That's
all right.
That's exactly where we were going with this. And that was a question I was talking with Cal before we got started. And we were discussing, as we do on a frequent basis, Cal and I talk quite often, but maybe not on Skype, but in one format or another. But one of the things that had always intrigued me, and it was a huge question mark to me, was how did the Federalists, the creators of the Constitution, how did they get a country, a society that had just fought a war to rid themselves of heavy taxation? How did they ever include into their Constitution the right of unlimited taxation from unlimited sources? How could you get a people who had just fought an 8-year bloody war to agree to even more of what they fought a war to get away from? And that always intrigued me. And I also, as Dave has brought up so many times, my thought has been, how does that parallel what we're staring down the barrel of today? Things haven't really changed. People do not change. Their names change, but people do not change. And so one of the things that I was thinking about that is that early on, so many people, including Patrick Henry and John DeWitt and whoever he actually was, that's the name he wrote under, and Brutus, and of course Luther Martin, and of course John Francis Mercer, and Agrippa, and Philadelphia, and so many others, Montezuma, of the Anti-Federalists, they caught on to this taxing thing. But probably the thing that I remember most about this, Patrick Henry is a close second, but what Luther Martin actually said and wrote, and I'm inclined to read that again, and please bear with me. I'm going to read through his quote, and it is, quote, "By the power to lay and collect imposts, they may impose duties on any or every article of commerce imported into these states to what amount they please. By the power to lay excises, a power very odious in its nature, since it authorizes officers to go into your houses, your kitchens, your cellars, and to examine into your private concerns, the Congress may impose duties on every article of use or consumption, on the food that we eat, on the liquors we drink, on the clothes that we wear, the glass which enlightens our houses, or the hearths necessary for our warmth and comfort. By the power to lay and collect taxes, they may proceed to direct taxation on every individual, either by a capitation tax on their heads or an assessment on their property. By this part of the section, therefore, the government has a power to lay what duties they please on goods imported, to lay what duties they please afterwards on whatever we use or consume, to impose stamp duties to what amount they please and in whatever case they please, afterwards to impose on the people direct taxes by a capitation tax or by assessment to what amount they choose, and thus to sluice them at every vein as long as they have a drop of blood without any control, limitation, or restraint, while all the officers for collecting these taxes, stamp duties, imposts, and excises are to be appointed by the central or general government under its directions, not accountable to the states, nor is there even a security that they will be citizens of the respective states in which they are to exercise their offices. At the same time, the construction of every law imposing any and all of these taxes and duties and directing the collection of them and every question arising thereon and on the conduct of the officers appointed to execute these laws and to collect these taxes and duties, so various in their kinds, are taken away from the courts of justice of the states and confined to the courts of the general government. There is to be heard and determined by judges holding their offices under the appointment, not of the states, but of the general government. Unquote. Luther Martin laid it out. Folks, stop and think of anything today that you touch, anything that you consume, anything that you claim you own that isn't taxed. And then look at what I call the chief revenue collection agency of the government, and that's the police. There are even reports now, and I have a good friend involved in law enforcement who said they are actually taking people off of homicide duty, taking people off of robbery duty, and putting people in patrol cars for traffic because the revenue collection was down because of the pandemic. And they make no money. As he told me, we make no money investigating a murder. The state realizes no profit from that. The state realizes no profit from investigating a robbery. But we do in the traffic courts. So there we have it. That, I believe, was a bit more eloquent. And especially I used Luther Martin in this instance about taxes because he was actually at the convention. And he listened to all of the discussion. So I think, not that I consider Patrick Henry irrelevant in any way or any of the other anti-federalists, but I find that Luther Martin just absolutely nailed it. So Cal, how does the people who have just been through 8-year war against a government that taxed them, they felt like, unfairly, how do you get a society to agree to be taxed unlimited from unlimited sources in a brand new government?
Well, first off, you'd have to say that not all of society accepted this. That's why the anti-federalists spoke out against it. And it's also why at most of the conventions, ratifying conventions, it was stacked with Federalists, i.e. the aristocracy of each state, because these taxes benefited them. I mean, the taxes are going to be paid by the yeoman. You know, there's no really such thing as a business tax. Everybody knows this. That tax gets passed along. You and I, the common everyday person, pays all taxes. And that's... The only way they could have gotten it through was they had to have had the ratification convention stacked, which is why so many of the actual votes in the ratification was by small margins. What, 5 people different in the Virginia ratification?
Right.
If 3 people changed their mind, Virginia would not have ratified. I mean, that's how close it was. It wasn't this overwhelming support for this new government and constitution. Especially when, you know, the outlying people got wind of and were subject to the new laws imposed by this government, which brought about the Whiskey Rebellion and such. So I guess there's a false narrative that the Constitution was this overwhelmingly accepted new form of government. It was that way because that's the narrative that's been portrayed to us. And it was also the narrative portrayed in the papers back then through, you know, fake news, so to speak. It was fake news back then. It's fake news now.
Well, I was impressed, and I got into this. I was impressed with seeing that the Federalist of 1787-1788 were no different than the people are today. They got people to submit to a constitution that provided the government with unlimited taxing authority by using the emotion of fear. So as the anti-federalists begin to write, hey, look at this tax mess. Well, you know, look at the ones who wrote, you know, John DeWitt, you know, Brutus Jr., Agrippa, and many others Philadelphia-nesis. And others went over and over and over again saying, look, this taxation will destroy us. We cannot survive this taxation. And as Patrick Henry said, we are submitting, and Sentinel, we are submitting to a government that is much more oppressive than the one we just fought a war to rid ourselves of. So the Federalists, who were James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay, they set about, oh man, we've got to get busy here because we have got to tell the people, look, they didn't, I'm sure, the thought was not, hey, we've got to inform the people. The fact was, we've got to scare the people into this. But their argument was fallacious, and for good reason. And Patrick Henry pointed that out at the Virginia Ratification Convention. They based their needs for unlimited taxation on, wait for it, national security. And Hamilton and Madison immediately jump in and go, oh, you know, we've got to defend ourselves. We've got to give ourselves the chance to defend ourselves. And we never know what we're going to be up against. We've got to defend ourselves. Over and over again, we've got to have the power to defend ourselves. Patrick Henry says in the Virginia Ratification Convention, from what? We have just defeated, with state militias, not a standing army, but with state militias, we have just defeated the most powerful military force on the planet. What the hell do we need a standing army for? So the whole plan throughout, starting with Federalist 8, going all the way through Federalist 30, all the way into the 60s even, was the reiteration by Madison and Hamilton, we have to have unlimited taxation because we need a standing army to protect us from the boogeyman. Because they couldn't come up with, we had just defeated the strongest military on the planet. What are you going to, how are you going to tell people? And when the anti-federalists would say, well, look how the great republics of the world did this. They did it with citizen armies. We need to leave the militias in the states, and they can be called up, and they can work in the states, and if they're needed for a national emergency, there can be an emergency provision put into the Constitution that says that when the entire country is under threat, or any state thereof from a foreign power, then we can call in the militias of all the states. Well, Hamilton and Madison knew that this wouldn't do. This would not justify unlimited taxation. And of course, they meant to use unlimited taxation for all kinds of stuff, especially creating a huge federal debt, which, you know, Hamilton said would be a blessing. Now, when in anybody's personal life has a debt ever been a blessing?
Well, so, Mike, it depends on your perspective, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, it depends on who's collecting the interest payments, right?
Right, and who Hamilton was really representing, which was, of course, the bankers.
Well, without a doubt, I think that's history has proved that over and over and over again. So, Cal, I know that you have looked into this. You and I started talking about this on Tuesday, I believe, in preparation. You looked into some of the arguments by the Federalists. What did you find?
We can start with Federalist 23, and it's Hamilton, and he's saying exactly what you said. And he says the authorities essential to the common defense are these: to raise armies, to build and equip fleets, to prescribe rules for the government of both, to direct their operations, to provide for their support. These powers ought to exist without limitation. That means unlimited. For all those who keep saying, no, there's no such thing as unlimited taxes. No, he just Madison or Hamilton saying, no, these powers ought to be unlimited, because it is impossible to foresee or define the extent and variety of national exigencies or the correspondent extent and variety of the means which may be necessary to satisfy them. In other words, we need to have the power to tax you unlimited because we don't know what the future holds, and we just need that power. And we're going to scare you because there's boogeymen out there. That's basically what he's saying. And the people bought it, apparently. I'm beside myself every time I read this stuff.
Well, one of the points,
understand how they passed this.
One of the points I think it's critical that we bring out, Cal, is that there was no resistance by the Anti-Federalists for a Navy. They felt like the Navy was needed. There was no resistance to that. But what the Anti-Federalists feared was a standing army. And why did they fear a standing army? They feared a standing army because they had just been subject to a standing army of King George that had stolen their property, taken their money, and done all of this stuff by force. The people in this society had experienced a standing army. They didn't want another one. Go ahead, Cal.
Well, that's just it. A standing army is a land-based force. Well, the land base is, you know, the colonies or the new states back then. That's the land. So why do we need a standing army in our states? The purpose of a navy is to protect commerce at sea. So, yeah, that you wouldn't be opposed. You would want a navy so that, you know, your ships aren't, you know, attacked by pirates, so that you can protect your commerce at sea. That's the purpose of the Navy. That was the purpose of a Navy. So, you know, an army is a subduing force, and the Navy is a protection force. They have two different roles, traditionally. Yes, navies can be used to invade, but they use the Marines when they do that, which is a form of an army. Does that make sense?
It does. Dave, you have any comments?
Well, this is just a fascinating conversation, and you know, the standing army is the sort of the muscle that the government has to use as force whenever they choose to, and without the funding from a central banking, it couldn't exist. It's a part of a infrastructure of tyranny that was being built, and I don't think a lot of people realized it. And you know, Mike, I just had sort of a corollary question to you. Because one of your themes is, you know, the government always ends up going horribly wrong, which I think is hard to dispute. And I was just curious if you knew of an example where government did not turn to tyranny over time.
I don't believe that example exists.
That's what I was thinking as well. And that really says a lot about the trajectory or the lifespan of a government will always end in one place, which is tyranny, especially if it has a standing army, the ability to tax as much as they want, whenever they want, and having a central bank to fund the whole operation.
Well, I had a person ask me one time this same type discussion, Dave, and I try to draw effective analogies. And someone said, well, would it be possible to have a government that would remain limited in scope and would never exceed its authority? And I said, oh, yeah. I said, can you have a child and make them forever 12?
That's a great analogy. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Because it's a natural progression. You see it in history. You could no more stop a government from becoming tyrannical then you could stop a child from growing and aging.
Well, right. And one thing, you know, I've noticed too, is with each new generation of people that, you know, inhabit the seats of power, they get more bold and want more power than the generation before them. That's part of this inevitable, creep into tyranny that you're talking about. It's inevitable.
Well, Dave, yes. look how the Constitution was set up. The Constitution was set up for a Congress that would meet every 2 years. We still have that. They call themselves what? Lawmakers. So are you going, would there ever be the chance that you would bring together a session of Congress to where they would spend their entire session doing away with antiquated laws that don't work? Or do they just keep adding on to the pile?
Right. They just keep adding on to the pile.
And so there, that is the natural progression of government. It's a law factory. And after a while, a government no longer concerns themselves with the criminal element. They concern themselves with the law-abiding citizen. Because criminals don't pay taxes.
That's a great point. Then thus enters domestic extremism and domestic terrorists into the picture, right?
Right. So you have to concern yourself with the law-abiding citizen because that is who you tax and tax and tax and tax and tax. And as Luther Martin said, 1787, they will sluice you at every vein until you have no more blood. And of course, see, that was a reference to being analogous to your blood is your money. And the government will sluice you at every vein until you have no more money, until you have no more blood. And once that's gone, your life is gone. And I believe that's exactly why we are today. There are so many non-productive people in society who have been made non-productive by government in order to get their votes that the time has come that the non-productive people have to be thinned out. It's time to cull the herd. We've got too many people. Too many people own too much property. They take up too much wealth. They're not paying taxes anymore. And people cannot understand that once you're in a population and you're no longer contributing to the government with your taxes, they don't need you anymore. And if they don't need you anymore, they'll find a virus or a vaccine to make sure that they thin the herd. I don't see how we can deny that. Of course, there are plenty of people who don't. But, you know, one of the things that always got to me and Cal, you and I have talked about this on multiple occasions, is the absolute, I don't know how James Madison lived with himself. Because I've said over and over and over, he was the Bill Clinton of the founding era. This man could come down on the same side of an issue in the same discussion. And we look at the writings of Madison over and over and over again, and he says, oh, we've got to have a standing army. We've got to have laws by implication. We've got to have powers by implication. You can't confine the government to its strict, expressly delegated authority. You just can't do that. But then in Federalist 45, he says exactly the opposite. Well, then he said that, hey, we've got to have a standing army because we never know what's going to happen. And I forgot which one, Federalist paper it was, but he said, yes, there is the danger that a standing army could become oppressive, but we have to take that chance. But then to put that in contrast, let me read something else he said. And he told exactly the truth on many occasions, and then he would tell blatant lies on the other, which contradicted the truth that he had told. But listen to this one and tell me if this isn't exactly where we are today. And I quote, of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded, because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From those proceed debt and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the shown instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied. and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manners and of morals engendered by both. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. Unquote. Now, this is the same guy that says you've got to have a standing army. When he says that war is the parent of armies, and these and out of these proceed debts and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. Would the real James Madison please roll over in your grave, please?
And Mike, if I could just add one thing quickly. You know, your analogy of comparing, you know, Madison to Bill Clinton is perfect, because it really helps people understand, like in a modern sense, what this man was like. Because if you think about it, Bill Clinton at his peak was the quintessential politician. I mean, he was really masterful. He would lie about anything, deeply corrupt, would just tell the public the biggest load of BS with a smile on his face, you know, and people would believe it because he had that charisma. And that's exactly the type of character you're describing here with Madison.
Well, it's, to me, it was amazing that Madison could continue to get by with this over and over and over. And now that Madison is heralded in today's world by all of these constitutional attorneys, these constitutional professors, he's the father of the Constitution. He's the father of the Bill of Rights. And he's probably the greatest hypocrite in American history. Followed closely by William Jefferson Clinton, of course. So, your thoughts, Cal?
Well, you nailed it with, you know, comparing Madison with Clinton. That's a great analogy. Madison was better at it than Clinton, though. I don't think Clinton could have got away with some of the stuff that Madison got away with.
Well, to me, it's uncanny that we've got, you know. And the other thing that always amazed me too is Thomas Jefferson's close affiliation with James Madison. And they were just ultra close. And, you know, and if you read the letters, and I'm sure you've seen them, Cal, because we've talked about them before. When you look at the letters, of course, Jefferson was in France when the Constitutional Convention was taking place. And you look at the letters between Madison was writing to Jefferson, telling Jefferson what's going on at the Constitutional Convention, and Jefferson's writing back. Of course, you have to understand that, you know, you didn't have email back then. It had to go by ship, which took considerably longer. So we don't know how much time frame was in there, but they were writing back and forth. And even to the points when after the convention was over and Jefferson is writing to Madison, and he's pointing out to Madison the faults in the Constitution, which Madison never mentions publicly. Madison still standing by with his faithful Federalist Alexander Hamilton, whom he splits with in 1792, because he begins to see the political tide flowing in the other direction, and it's time to jump on board with my good friend Thomas Jefferson. So then Madison and Hamilton have a war of words between, I'm trying to think, it was Pacificus and someone else, but they wrote under different names. But even Hamilton and Madison had a falling out. So, but I do not believe that was on intellectual grounds as much as it was political grounds. And there was no way that Madison could see his future, including being Secretary of State, President of the United States, all of this stuff. No way would that have happened if Madison hadn't made this switch from the Federalist point of view to the Jeffersonian point of view in 1792. Thoughts on that, Cal? Mike? You've read that as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wanted to point out one other thing is with the standing army, that precludes war. You know, if you can have a standing army, you might as well have a war. If you have a war, you might as well have a standing army. Another thing that that naturally precludes is it consolidates power into the executive, whether it be president or a king or an emperor or the same thing. It consolidates that power into an emperor, and it because of war, it destroys that so-called balance of powers. It just naturally does, and it's just one of the natural things of government that's what happens. I mean, even Trump, I mean, he got away with imposing steel tariffs, calling it national security, where the president doesn't even have the authority under the Constitution to impose a tariff. That's a power given to Congress, you know, delegated to the Congress. But because of national security, even Trump was able to, well, I'm going to impose this tariff, national security. And that's what national security does. That's exactly what Hamilton and Madison were claiming and how they got away with what they got away. And it's how the presidents today still get away with what they get away with.
Well, you know, national security is the blanket the government hides under when the people get pissed.
Yeah, it's the elixir of life for tyrants, because you can apply it to anything.
Well, you know, what you have said when you utter those words, national security, you have said all dissenters shut up. You have no case.
Yeah,
and it also leads to secrecy. We can't explain to you why, because it's top secret and it's a matter of national security. So just do what we say.
Mm-hmm. And the National Secrecy Act, guys, I've read it on multiple occasions. Why did we originally decide that it was okay to have secret, top secret documents?
That's been around the whole time. There's always been some kind of secrecy between diplomatic causes and stuff.
Well, when they had to justify it, Cal, who did they say that we had to have secrets to protect us from whom?
Oh, that was on the heels of World War II, I believe, and the communists.
We have to have secrets to protect ourselves from our enemies. That is the whole basis of the national security apparatus, is to protect us from our enemies. When the government is keeping secrets from the people, it is considering the people its enemy.
That's the point Snowden brought out.
Right.
When he exposed what was going on, he's like, I expose it to the people, not the enemy.
Well,
are the enemy of the government.
And that is one of the things that I saw during my tenure, was when I saw that switch, a huge swing in the focus of the government as far as intelligence matters was concerned, was in the late 70s, early 80s, when the focus in the intelligence communities of America shifted from our foreign enemies to our domestic enemies. And domestic enemies are considered anyone who questions what the hell you're doing with their money. So, guys, stop and think, is there any time in maybe our history that we actually had a president who tried very diligently to not and to handle the government in the way that a standing army was not needed?
I would say the closest would be Jefferson.
Well, Cal, you're right on. And I would read this paragraph and these are Jefferson's words. In the transaction of your foreign affairs, We have endeavored to cultivate the friendship of all nations, and especially of those with which we have the most important relations. That's trade, people. We have done them justice on all occasions. Holy damn. We have done these countries, these nations, justice on all occasions. Favored where favor was lawful, and cherished mutual interest and intercourse on fair and equal terms. In other words, if a country had a resource that you needed, you traded for it equitably as friends. You didn't use your standing army to take it away from them. You went to the grocery store to buy food, not to steal it. Now, there are some of you that say that's an oversimplification, but it's not. If we covet the oil of the countries in the Middle East, then we should have gotten onto a trading platform to wherein we would pay an equitable price for what they had. And we shouldn't have formed standing armies to go take what they have. And for those of you who don't think that has happened, I would please ask you to read a book by John Perkins called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Our military is used to create an empire. It doesn't have a damn thing to do with protecting your rights, people. That's a pipe dream. Has been for 100 and some years. Any thoughts on that subject, gentlemen?
Well, in Federalist 28, Hamilton speaks about why there needs to be a standing army. And he actually mentions that it's used to put down so-called an insurrection or rebellion in the states. It's like, wait a minute, isn't that what everybody just did back in 1775 through 1781? You were insurrectionists and rebelling against the crown. And then here he is proposing that we need to have a force strong enough to stop that from ever happening again. He proved it right, because in 1861, a standing army was able to put down the so-called rebels. Having a standing army is so contrary. It's called the bane of liberty. I mean, it's actually expressed that way back then, that it's the bane of liberty to have a standing army. It is one of the roots of all destruction of liberty.
And very well said, Cal, but we don't have to go to 1860. We could start in 1792.
Oh, yeah, we could start with the Whiskey Rebellion.
So when the people of Massachusetts, well, in several states, it wasn't just Pennsylvania, people. That is you really need to read up on the Whiskey Rebellion. There were people throughout the country, Virginia, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, there were people throughout the country revolting over the whiskey tax, because they saw immediately who it was aimed at, because it was the yeoman, the common, ordinary, everyday person who was using whiskey as a means of barter and a means of trade in many instances. That was one of their ways of creating money. And they saw that Alexander Hamilton, as Secretary of Treasury, placed a tax on whiskey, but not on wine. Because wine was considered the drink of the wealthy aristocracy, so there would be no tax. But we're going to tax you suckers out there that are working for a living. We're going to tax you, and you're going to pay the taxes for the wealthy and the well-born so they can have a better class of life. And the people throughout the country saw that. But Hamilton knew that he could not invade every state, or they call themselves their country. He knew that he could not do that. But he did go to and raise an army of about 13,000 to 15,000 troops, depending on what source you read, He raised an army larger than any army that Washington had had under his command during the Revolutionary War at any one time. Raised an army larger than fought for their freedom to go take their freedom in western Pennsylvania. And Washington took command of the army as president of the United States. And he made the commander, his assistant, Major General Alexander Hamilton, who was the Secretary of the Treasury. And then when they moved in, of course, the poor farmer and mechanic, as they were called back then, the yeoman, saw there was no way they could stand up against this force. And so they capitulated. And what did Hamilton want? He wanted them all to be hanged. Thank goodness Washington wouldn't do that. He pardoned him. But in 1792, 3 years after the Constitution is the form of law, the President and the Secretary of Treasury violate the Constitution in order to forcibly go put down a tax rebellion. Anybody find anything ironic about that?
Completely.
Dave, any thoughts before you take off, my friend?
Well, Mike, you know, the fact that Hamilton wanted to hang all of the so-called rebels, and which is, of course, was a deeply unfair tax. And like you said, taxing the working man and letting the elite who sip on their glasses of wine not pay tax. It's so in your face, you know, it smacks of elitism. The fact that Hamilton wanted to hang all those people, that's the thinking of a king. And it goes back to our discussions earlier about how Hamilton actually wanted to have a monarchy.
Oh, very much so. As a matter of fact, you can go to the official records on June 18th of 1787. Hamilton made a full-on pitch for a monarchy, and it's right there in the records, people. That's why we have a play today for Alexander Hamilton, and we don't have a play for Luther Martin or Patrick Henry or Brutus or Samuel Bryan or any of the people who saw through this mess. It's part of the continual indoctrination. Thoughts, Cal?
We started this off. You introduced this to me last Tuesday by giving me the last paragraph from John DeWitt's fourth essay. And in it, he talks about how it was what we were talking about, that anytime you have a standing army, that eventually the people will be overrun by it. It will end up controlling them. And I was reading the rest of John DeWitt, you know, to follow it. And the end of the paragraph right before it, he says, in short, do they not preclude the necessity of any standing army whatsoever, unless in case of invasion? And in that case, it would be time enough to raise them for no free government under heaven with a well-disciplined militia has ever yet been subdued by mercenary troops. So if you fast forward to that to today, and you understand that the U.S. military today is nothing more than a mercenary force, understanding that they're actually working for big pharma and big oil and big whatever, that's true. I mean, they were a mercenary force in Vietnam, and the Vietnamese were able to repel them. It's been that way in Afghanistan, Iraq, they overthrew them. But yeah, it's... The truth in that is if you have a militia, if a country actually invaded here, the largest army in the world exists here because so many people own firearms. So I don't understand why people are worried about an invasion. I just don't, especially in today's modern technology, where you would see the invasion coming by approaching. In order for, you know, someone like China or Russia to ever invade here, they would have to amass troops somewhere. And no doubt, U.S. intelligence would pick it up with their spy satellites. You just can't get away with it in today's age. So even the argument today just falls apart. There's still no need for a standing army. We're not going to be invaded, people. So it's just not going to happen. It's not in anyone's best interest.
Well, what yes, was but that Cal, thing? What about the army of hobgoblins that are just waiting to get us? What about them?
Well, that's just it. You can plan to be afraid of everything and you know, live your life under your bed in fear and let the government completely control you. Or you can, you know, have a little bit of courage, a little bit of strength, a little bit of understanding of, you know, geopolitics. China is, you know, they have the largest resource, natural resource in the world, that being people, actual people. That is the greatest resource on earth, is people and the ability of people. And they have the most of them. They have the greatest resource. Eventually, their economy, if they continue, will outgrow the United States economy. It's inevitable because they've got 100 billion more people than we do. It's just going to happen, you know. So, but that doesn't mean that, you know, the United States, because it's not the number one economy in the world, is going to be any, you know, is going to be subservient to China. It doesn't necessarily mean that. You know, it's not in China's best interest to destroy the economy of the United States, just like it's not in the best interest of the United States to destroy the economy of China. They can exist symbiotic with each other. People want cheap stuff created in China, and they're going to pay money for it. You know, that's just how free markets work.
All right, folks, there's the break, and we shall see you on the other side of Dare to Think Out Loud.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
The evasion.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
And Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. And there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came and unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. so be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
If you think for one second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Well, thanks everyone for coming back for hour two of our Dare to Think Out Loud. Our producer and good friend Dave Scorpio has absconded to take care of personal business related to getting himself back into the country while he can without having to forcibly take, the vaccine. Before we kick off to get back into our discussion of national security, standing army, and unlimited taxation as a justification for national security and a standing army, I would like to go back and to tell folks again, because I think we've got some important programs coming up. We've got one this Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and that will be my friend DW and I on Addicted to Your Own Destruction, and we will be talking with Paul English from Britain. I kidded him. I told him that this past week that we would like to have him on, and all we want to do is to listen to him read the phone book so we can hear that great British accent. But he would not consent to that. So we're going to talk about money and banking. And then a week from today on this very platform at this very same time, DW Cal and I will be talking with Pastor Ted Weiland. And our subject will be, is the Constitution Christian? Which should be a great discussion. I would ask everyone to please read Ted Weiland's website, if you would. Read about him, read about his stance. And also, please, if you would, go to Telegram and Rebel Madman. And where I post with some frequency lessons on the Constitution, points made, and also some beautiful memes who really get across our point of view. Well, Cal, you want to give us somewhat of a thought of a summation of our first hour, please, sir?
Yeah, we've been discussing whether or not a standing army is prudent in the securing of the rightful liberty of the people would be a rough overview of what we've talking about. And we discussed how having a standing army necessitates the need for what is known as unlimited taxation. So if you're going to have a standing army, you're going to have unlimited taxation. If you have unlimited taxation, you have a purpose for a standing army. They go hand in hand together. And the anti-federalists tried to point out that, well, we don't really need a standing army. We can get by with just a militia. And a militia would be more serving to securing the rights of the people. That's the main argument we're discussing today.
Well, thanks for that summation, Cal. And let's look at something here. We've covered the argument pretty well in the first hour. And then it seemed to be, as the Constitution appeared ratification, or approached ratification, I should say, as it approached ratification, the anti-federalists saw that there was going to be some problems with this standing army with unlimited taxation. So several states offered amendments to the Constitution, and there were over 200 in total. Some would change the structure of the government. Others would amend to protect the rights of the people, their creator-endowed rights, not government rights. So, Cal, this national security issue, this standing army issue, did the states throw out as proposed amendments to try to neutralize these powers?
And what proposals did the states make to neutralize having a standing army?
The standing army and the unlimited taxation. What did they attempt to do with their amendments?
I'd have to pull up my... I have a list of the 20 proposed amendments that Virginia had.
Well, I've kind of...
go find it, but hopefully you have that answer.
I've kind of jumped on you here, Cal. That was... I didn't prepare you for that question, but I really wanted to throw that question out to the listeners, to the people who are listening to our program. So when the anti-federalists saw that in all probability this thing was going to get ratified, okay, all right, now we have this enemy. We have unlimited taxation coming at us in this Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. We have this this standing army coming at us, and I think it was Article 1, Section 8, Clause 12. We've got this, we've got unlimited taxation and a standing army, two things we absolutely did not want, two things we fought a war to rid ourselves of, and here they are back in full force. How can we amend this Constitution to stop this threat to the liberties of the people? So they came up with two things. Number one, every state which offered amendments offered a prohibition of direct taxation on individuals. They didn't want that to happen. They wanted, if the federal government needed tax money, they could allocate it to the states proportionate to population and tell the states, here's the money we got to have. Patrick Henry made the assessment in the Virginia Ratification Convention that the taxes should be on the states, because if for some reason, whatever reason, the states cannot produce that money, the federal government cannot charge them with a crime and take away their freedom. But if they have a direct capitation on the head of the people, an income tax, so to speak, or on directly on an individual's property, then the government can take their property or can also take their freedom. And so we need something to prevent that. So that's why they all came up, every state that offered amendments, not all states, because not all states offered amendments, but every state that offered an amendment said, okay, we want no direct taxation on individuals. That was to combat Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. Then to combat the standing army, all of the states that submitted amendments submitted what we call today the Second Amendment. So they said, look, we know we've had to fight the Redcoats. So if the standing army is perverted to our best interest and they attempt to take our freedoms, we need the right and the ability to protect ourselves. We have that right, granted by our Creator. We want it written. We want it in words. And therefore, we have the Second Amendment. But here is what started happening, you know, well over 100 years ago, is that to be able to defend yourself against a standing army, you need to be able to have the same type weapons as that standing army. Otherwise, it's futile. So the government, realizing this right away, started saying, okay, we got to start restricting what they can own down to the point to where we say they can't own a damn thing, which is where we are now. But it started well over 100 years ago. Okay, and just for you folks who didn't know, the first gun control, that's why I've said from the beginning, gun control is racist, because the first gun control laws in this country were to keep weapons out of the hands of black slaves. So now we're all slaves, so they don't want anybody to own a gun, and it's coming quick with this Marxism. So any thoughts on that, Cal?
No, that makes total sense. It's too bad that the Bill of Rights is nothing but a tub to the well, the Bill of Goods.
Well, you know, nothing proves that better, Cal. Nothing, absolutely nothing proves that better than the Second Amendment. Because we've still got people running around. We've got groups collecting money all over and have been for years, collecting millions of dollars to defend the Second Amendment. And yet the more they defend it, the more laws we have. And the American public just can't seem to catch on to this deal. It's like any time the federal government declares war on something, we get more of it. We had the war on poverty in 68. And now we have more poverty than we ever had. Especially now after their pandemic. We had the war on drugs in the 1960s. Now we have more people using drugs than we've ever had people using drugs. And most of them are using legal drugs. And the pushers are protected. You can't sue your pusher.
And I thought
today, yesterday, my wife and I saw an advertisement on TV. It was one for some drug, and it had more things that could go wrong than could ever help you. And it might have been to keep fungus off your toenails. I don't know. But it was some crazy drug that you could have. And they read off very quickly the side effects. And then they said, well, if the COVID-19 has kept you from being able to purchase your drugs, we can help you apply here for free drugs. Well, isn't that what a pusher does? Don't they give you free stuff to get you hooked? I mean, is the government and their big pharma, are they not the largest pushers
exactly.
in existence? Sometimes, Cal, I look at this and I tell you what, it gets harder and harder to figure out why that people can't catch on to this. But then I realize that with our wonderful public fool system, thinking has been bred out of the American populace. There is no thinking. Everything is done with emotions.
That is true.
So if you can't feel it, if you can't feel that thing, you know, if it's not an emotional thing, don't worry about it.
If it's rational, it makes sense, but goes against my feelings, I'm going to go with my feelings instead of rationality and common sense.
Exactly. Let's not think about anything. let's not think about anything for sure. Let's get on to it. You know, let's make sure that we, you know, let's get rid of the statue of Thomas Stonewall Jackson at Virginia Military Institute, not because he was a racist. Well, he didn't own slaves, and he violated the law because he had secret meetings to teach blacks to read so they could improve their own lot in life. But let's tear down that statue because he was a racist.
It's ignorance, Mike.
And it, you know, my goodness, it's just everybody is feeling their way through life. And everybody who feels their way through life ends up in one hell of a lot of trouble, Cal. We all know that. So I'm looking for something in particular in my notes. Will you kind of carry our conversation here for just a second, my friend?
Well, sure. You know, even the Federalists, you know, James Madison, Hamilton, they came up with truths. The best way to sell a lie is to tell a few truths with it so that you can, you know, distract the people with a lie. And one of the things that Hamilton wrote, and this comes from Hamilton, from Federalist 28 or 30. And it's he says, the obstacles to usurpation and the facilities of resistance increase with the increased extent of the state. In other words, the bigger the government or the bigger the state, the more risk there is that there's going to be usurpations of your rights. But provided the citizens understand their rights and are disposed to defend them. In other words, all of this is for naught. If people don't understand what their rights are, number one, and number two, if they're not disposed or have the inclination to defend their rights, it's also frivolous. The Constitution, all of it. I mean, if people are not willing to actually stand up for and defend their rights, you're not going to have any rights because the government's not going to protect them. The government is the biggest usurper of rights there is. You're in more danger of losing your rights to the government than to random Joe Sixpack walking down the street. So unless people are willing to defend their rights, none of these discussions have any relevancy. Would that be an accurate assessment, Mike?
Absolutely, Cal. Absolutely. And I've got a couple of things here that I would like to, statements I would like to run by, Cal, for your comment. And here is one. The American government is no more worthy in its present formation and policy to raise a banner of freedom than is the thundering crew of political slave masters headquartered in the Kremlin. Your thought?
I would agree with that. It's just a different form of slavery or servitude. One might be a little more oppressive in one area or not, but the United States government is well on its way towards being just like the Kremlin used to be during the Soviet era. And it's not just because of those damn Democrats. The Republicans are following right along. They're just controlled opposition.
Well, what would you say to this statement? Humanity the world over is sunk under a weight of excessive bureaucracy sired by socialist ideologists.
I would agree with that.
Well, if the
bureaucracy of government is a parasite, they're a parasitical class of people. If you want to break things into class, I mean, you call them aristocracy, they're parasites. They leech off of the fruits of the labor of others. They don't produce, government doesn't really produce anything. Government exists by taking from everybody. That's what their job is. That's why it's the natural forward progression of government to become more and more tyrannical.
Well, here is a statement that I wish Americans could catch on to, Cal. I truly wish that Americans could understand this very simple statement. If the crack in the Liberty Bell is to be welded shut so that the tocsin call to freedom and rightful liberty can be heard among the world's oppressed, it must be free men outside of government who perform the welding task. No government that curtails or inhibits individual liberty can possibly man the universal carry-on. Your thought?
That's an excellent statement. Yes, I completely agree with that. Liberty, true rightful liberty exists outside of government. Government is antithetical to rightful liberty.
It must be people outside of that government to bring back freedom. The people inside of that government never will, because it's not to their benefit to do so. And that's why people have to give up this foolish idea. Almost said a bad word. People give up this foolish idea that freedom can be found in the ballot box. It does not exist in the ballot box. You're just, it's like electing a new guy to the mafia. If he can't be corrupted to do the job that they need done, they'll get rid of him. Case in point, John Kennedy. What is needed is a rebirth in the spirit of rightful liberty. The Declaration of Independence that we should call our founding document and not that damn Constitution contained that spirit. That spirit of rightful liberty is nowhere to be found in the Constitution. Do not forget that the people who wrote that thing did not want a Bill of Rights attached to it and voted unanimously to keep it out. The rights of the people had no place in their meeting, and it certainly had no place in their document. That is why James Wilson said that a Bill of Rights was both superfluous and absurd. That's exactly what they thought of your rights and your freedom, people. The Declaration of Independence, it was limited, not by the desire of the authors, as was the Constitution, but by the circumstances under which it was produced. The oppressed colonists of that prior day were concerned with independence from Britain, just as the people today should be concerned with the independence from this damn oppressive tyrannical government. The oppressed individualists of our generation are concerned and should be concerned with independence from government. They are conscious that moral law must provide the base of our society. We should be becoming conscious now that governments, by their very nature, tend to subvert moral law in the interest of expedience. We could quote hundreds of examples of that. A new Declaration of Independence is in order. To meet the challenges of collectivism, socialism, Marxism, all of these isms, it must be a declaration of individual independence, not collective independence. Any thoughts, Cal?
No, you summed it up right well right there, Mike.
Let me throw a proposed declaration of individualism at you. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one individual to dissolve the political bonds which have held him under the dominance of any state, and thus to assume his full stature as a human being among the others of his kind, in compliance with highest moral law, and in conformity with nature's laws, and in deep humility before nature's God. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that he should declare the courses which impel him to thus stand forth a free being and subservient to no one. These truths are to be held self-evident, that each man is better qualified to govern his own affairs than any other man or combination of men or agencies are so qualified. that he is endowed by his creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, private ownership of property, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, each man is qualified to select for himself that agency or those agencies which seem to him best suited to protect his life and his property, to maintain his freedom, and which lie within his ability to afford. That whenever any agency evinces characteristics of tyranny, he is well within his rights and his powers to discharge that agency and to find another more suitable to his inclinations and his finances. That he is competent to accomplish this end singly or jointly with others, with the express understanding that no single person may be coerced or trespassed against in the formation or the maintenance of any such joint enterprise. Experience indeed will dictate that governments in practice erode and destroy the individuality of man by virtue of the coercion they exercise against their own citizens. Therefore, he will take due cognizance of this fact, and should a new government be decided advisable and most likely to affect his safety and happiness, he will see to it that the just powers of that government shall be derived from the individual consent of those governed. No man shall be compelled to pay a tax for a product or a service he does not wish to have. On the contrary, each man wishing such product or service shall bear the full pro rata cost of that product or service without resort to massive collective taxation. No man, in making this individual declaration, is seeking by so doing to overthrow or subvert any existing government. He is, rather, intent upon stopping the long train of abuses and usurpations which have pursued a single object of placing him under absolute despotism. If others want tyranny, he is content to let them pursue it to their pleasure. He seeks only to stand free of the political shackles that fetter his own wrists. He will not use force to secure his objective. He will obey the edicts of his rulers when he is compelled to obey, as long as they are morally just. But he will no longer volunteer to further tyranny, either by beseeching subsidy or support, or by accepting it should it be granted him. He will make his own way, for better or for worse, and hold himself accountable to his God for his success and for his failure. Would you take that, sign that declaration, Cal?
Well, first question, is this a Rebel Madman original?
In part.
In part, okay. I would wish to make an amendment to it and change where you put financially in the first part, something about financial. Change that word to just strictly to abilities.
Good suggestion. Yeah, I accept that.
Okay, just because, you know, I might not have a lot of money, but you know. I do have abilities to defend myself without having a lot of money. I do have that ability, and I have the natural right to do that. Add in the words at the end of it, that I pledge my life, my fortune, and my sacred honor. Yeah, I'll sign it.
Well, I have thought so many times in doing these studies and what have you, is that Patrick Henry was extremely concerned with a government that could rule over the individual. And he spoke very eloquently that should such a government be established, liberty could not exist under that government. And yeah. I think he was exactly right. And that takes me back to a question I asked on our learning platform and to which you answered. And I've asked this question of people, and they don't like it. These people who tell me about how the Constitution was divinely inspired, that, you know, it was all this wonderful work that these people were trying to protect the freedoms of America. I don't know what comic book they've been reading, but they go into this long ideal, and especially those who claim it was divinely inspired. And my question has always been, well, then what about Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry was spoken of by his fellow founders, framers, whatever you want to call them, as the most devout Christian among the founders. Why did the man who was called the most devout Christian fight harder against ratification of the Constitution than anyone? And they don't want to answer this question, Cal. Have you figured out why?
They're cognitive dishonest. They've been raised in the public school system with the George Washington cut down the cherry tree mythological version of U.S. history, so to speak. It's out of ignorance, not full of understanding. But the saddest part is you could point out the truth. You could give them the source documents, let them read that for themselves, and they still deny it or don't see it. And, you can lead a man to water, but you can't make him drink. You know, you can lead a man to knowledge, but you can't make him think. So, ultimately, it's up to the individual to accept the truth or reject it.
Well, but at some point in time, you have to admit, at least I believe on their part, they have to admit that they're rejecting logic.
Well, yeah, they are, but they're dealing on emotion, and logic is irrelevant. It's emotion that matters.
Well, Cal, you and I are both also cognizant of the charlatans out there who call themselves wall builders and constitutional attorneys who are propagating this lie.
Oh, yeah, and it's gotten so much so that, just because they say it's this way, it's that way. Even though you bring evidence against it, they just dismiss it out of hand. That's not history. That's not truth. You can't dismiss factual source document evidence out of hand and not weigh what has been said or been done. But they do constantly because it doesn't fit their narrative. And I think most of that is because they have a financial interest invested in selling the myth. They make money, a good living, out of selling the myth to people who want to hear the story, the myth. They want to believe the myth to their own detriment.
Cal, are you trying to say these people are selling lies?
Yeah, well, they're selling lies and half-truths, and some of it is their own ignorance. They're not aware of this. It takes a lot of effort to find some of this source document. But yeah, they are selling lies. Either willingly or unwillingly, they're selling lies and half-truths. Yes.
Well, here's the point. I can understand that they're selling something that they believe is true. But when they are offered evidence that proves that what they're teaching is false, what should we call them when they go on teaching it anyway, because that is a source of money or revenue?
Let's see. You would call them Pharisees, scribes, and hypocrites, I believe.
I prefer prostitutes.
Okay, prostitutes. Okay. I was just trying to set it up for next week. Pharisees, scribes, and hypocrites.
Well, That was a good effort.
Because, history continues to repeat itself. the situation is very similar to back then.
Oh, very much so. I look at these things and it just absolutely... Sometimes...
Well, Mike, given you and I go out there and you share the truth and the rest of those of us doing it, good and well that there's people out there, if they had it within their power, they'd do everything they could to silence us, include having us just completely removed from the face of the earth. That's how they view us. Of people who have gone out and spoke the truth and have paid a dear penalty for doing so.
Yes, some of them
one,
have
one whose to, book who just came out. Yes,
yeah, some have had to go to federal prison, and I tell you what, there is just a when you've been a political prisoner, and you have endured that, and you have come out on the other side, and you are still preaching truth. I could not hold anyone in higher esteem than I do those individuals, and I know several. And my life has been blessed with those people. And, you know, the one thing that I truly and firmly believe is you can bring all your oppression, you can bring all your tyranny, but it's like we go back to that film of, you know, with what's his name about? What was the guy's name in Scotland? Wallace, William Wallace, Braveheart.
Yeah, William of Wallace. Yeah.
Yeah. They say freedom or liberty as a dying breath. And to me, there is no higher position than to leave this world with freedom and rightful liberty on your mind or on your lips. Because to me, that's the very essence of our being.
I totally agree with that. That's the whole purpose of mankind, is the pursuit of liberty. That's my opinion. To learn and understand liberty.
Oh, absolutely. Cal, you and I have had some great discussions at times. The one thing I like about it is we don't always agree. If we always agreed, I'd know there was something wrong with you.
Oh, exactly. It's not so much we disagree. Sometimes it's just on how the narrative should be put.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a disagreement.
You know, the general overall understanding, you know, we're on the same page. It's like, yeah, but let's just change the sentences a little bit. That's about as far as the disagreements ever go.
Yeah, and it's all right to be taking different roads as long as you've got the same destination in mind.
Exactly. Well, the thing is I learn from other. If someone's on the same road as I am and I can learn from their perspective, that's a benefit for me. It doesn't make that person an enemy of me. We're on the same path. I cherish that people are different on their path, on their own individual path of liberty. I like the different viewpoints because they might see something I didn't see from their perspective. And then I can bring that into my perspective, and that makes it better for me. That's how rightful liberty works. That's one of those blessings of rightful liberty.
Absolutely. Carry on just a little bit here. I'm looking for something else right now, Cal.
Where should we go with this? You caught me at a loss of words there, Mike.
Sometimes I do that on purpose. I'm sorry.
Oh, I know. It's like, all right, we were talking about rightful liberty. I mean, before the show, Mike and I were talking, and one of the things that was different back during what you would call the founding era and today is that many of the people put their liberty above their country. I mean, think about it. These people were British colonists. They were loyal to the king. They were proud British subject. They were proud that they were English, that they were British. But after the long train of abuses, they began to discover that, well, actually, we're really more proud and more loyal to our rights, to our liberty. So much so that on July 6th, 1775, this is almost a complete year before the Declaration of Independence, the Continental Congress wrote a letter to the Crown. And to explain, it's called the Declaration of the Causes and Necessities for Taking Up Arms. And it's their response into what had happened at Lexington and Concord. And in it, Jefferson's the principal author, and this is something Jefferson wrote. In it, he wrote that no attachment to no nation upon earth shall supplant our attachment to liberty. In other words, they were placing liberty, their liberty, rightful liberty, each individual's liberty, above country, above nation. And I think people calling themselves Americans have kind of got that a little, have lost that. They place their country above liberty. And the genesis of what became this country was, no, you have to place liberty above country. If you place liberty first, your country will, whatever country or however that country turns out, will be in liberty. And that's the pursuit. It's liberty, not country. And if you have a country as small as the state of Georgia, or as large as the state of Texas, or as small as even the burg of Manhattan, then that's what it is. You let the people coalesce together in their own liberty instead of this forced nation that we're under right now. Does that make any sense, Mike?
Oh, yes.
Go ahead. I realize I step out way out ahead of, you know, where the narrative is, and I don't know if people have a frame of reference to understand what I'm trying to explain. It's just this is not stuff taught in high school civics.
All right. Well, Cal, let me read a little something here too, and let's discuss this. As we look at government, we find that men have organized for the purpose of protecting themselves and their property. Government is the tool of this protection, allegedly. Also, since government is always an agency which plans to use and indeed must use force and coercion, we have noted that government derives its power from a compulsory unification. All persons under the jurisdiction of a particular government are compelled to agree with whatever that government does. The agreement can be enthusiastic, tacit, or reluctant, but the agreement must be there. Government's power to protect is based upon that agreement. However secured, power to be effective cannot permit exceptions. Thus, the government is inevitably opposed to the individual. Think about that declaration I just read. The individual is the natural prey of the organizational tool. And we have shown that when the individual is immoral, mentally retarded, or physically aggressive against others, the government can employ its cohesive power in a manner which is pleasing to the people in general. In short, it can act defensively, taking a position against the one on behalf of the many. So long as the matter is simple, the case clear-cut, the individual obviously out of order, and the protection of the people generally the paramount issue, the government is fulfilling what people generally expect of it. But matters are rarely simple, and cases have a way of being complicated and fogged over with a combination of motives, behavior patterns, backgrounds, and prejudice. Thus, more times than not, an individual will object to some particular government action only to find himself, by reason of his objection, the object and the victim of governmentalism. A peaceful and law-abiding citizen, for example, may have perfectly sound and moral reasons why he does not wish to share his money with the government or the politicians of another country. His conviction can be logically derived, morally certain, and sincerely maintained. In holding to his conviction, the individual is harming no one. His belief is not inimical to the welfare of other people. actions which might spring from his belief are not aggressive. In other words, physically, mentally, and morally, such a citizen can be above reproach. Yet, when the government adopts a policy which prescribes the sharing of his earnings with a foreign government, the man who objects to this can be treated in precisely the same manner as a bank robber could be treated, and for the same reason. The government cannot brook a deviationist. If the government decrees against bank robbing, it can permit of no exception. It will use its full force and unified power to prevent bank robbing, or at worst, to apprehend and punish the robber should one appear. And if the government decrees a universal sharing of its citizens' wealth with the politicians of another country, it can permit of no exception here. It can and it will use its full force of unified power to collect whatever sums it deems advisable, and will punish any person refusing to provide those sums with arrest, fine, or imprisonment, and in the event of resistance, with death. Thus, in practice, the tool of protection, which men have devised out of their weaknesses, can be employed and is employed with equal vigor and ferocity against both the criminal and the good and harmless citizen. Here, the bank robber and the patriot who loves his country are equated. Government has but a single standard, obedience. It decrees good, bad, or indifferent. Its decrees, good, bad, or indifferent, are enforceable. And the men in government cannot recognize a law which need not be enforced. If the government has adopted a policy, the policy must be carried out, even though the one policy may be aimed at social stability and the other at social injustice. This is one of the characteristics of weakness contained in man's nearly universal tool of strength. The device of protection can be employed as a weapon both defensively and aggressively. Your thoughts, Cal?
Is that a Rebel Madman original?
No.
No?
No.
It sounds like one.
Well, I must admit that what I'm reading from now, I read 20-some years ago. Well, gosh, Mike, you're older than you think you are. I first read this in the 80s. And I don't think anything has influenced me more than some of these thoughts. And I will share them with you, Cal, at your convenience, sir.
Okay. Well, to look at that is, all right, in understanding rights, I, or you, Mike, have the natural right of self-defense. That's a right inherent to us, you know, to defend our life, our property, our liberty, our pursuit of happiness. That's just, it's just a natural right. It comes to us as a birthright as being a human. You and I together can, you know, I can come to your mutual aid to defend you. You can come to my mutual aid to defend me. We can come to each other's mutual aid to defend ourselves. Now, if you or I are attacked by an assailant and we repel that person, do you say that you governed that person that you repelled?
I mean, you've governed their actions.
But see, here's the thing: is you can't delegate a right that you don't have. Now, you have the right to defend yourself, and a group of people have a right to defend the rights of the individuals. But where government steps in is, and you threw that word in there, and this is where government strays away from rightful liberty, as you said, compelled. Once it's compelled, if I'm compelled to defend you, Mike, or you're compelled to defend me, we have now strayed from the premise of rightful liberty. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes.
And that's where government strayed. This is, you have to go way back to the start of this, back down to where all rights begin with, which originate in the individual, and expand upon there to understand government, if you're to have government. And once you throw that word compelled or forced or coerced into the narrative, you have strayed from the path of rightful liberty, because you can't force. I can't force rightful liberty upon anybody, even. I can't. So that's why if somebody wants to live under tyranny and have somebody tell them how they're going to live, that's their right to do that. They just can't compel me to also be underneath that. And that's where we're at right now is, you know, I don't want to live by being compelled by the left wing or the right wing. I want to live my own way. And I'm not going to harm anybody in doing it. Just leave me alone. Let me live my life. You live your life. If you want to wear a mask, you want to get a shot, feel free to do it. You know, that's your business, not mine. I'm not going to say anything one way or the other. Just leave me alone. If I don't want to wear a mask, I ain't got to get a shot. And I don't think people can quite make that understanding until it's been pointed out. And then it takes time for your brain to wrap yourself around that ideology. Is that making any sense?
Yeah. Cal, one of the things that has stuck out in my mind, and I know I have made just a whole bunch of right-wing Christian conservatives angry at me when I've asked them about their support for government. And I've said, have you any idea how much of your tax dollar is appropriated by government to promote abortion? And they get downright offended at that. They go, no. I said, yeah, it is. I'm sorry.
The other thing is they get upset over abortion, but they have no problem with collateral damage.
Oh, well, they cheer that.
Well, yeah. Fine. Ooh. If you want to, then, you know, write a check to the government. Quit compelling me to pay for it.
Yeah, Cal, I was trying to think of who it was years ago, and you made it pop into my mind, of some guy who was, it may have been George Carlin, but anyway, who said that these wonderful Christian conservatives are all for protecting the life of the unborn. And they're willing to protect the life of the unborn. And even after they're born, they're willing to protect their life right up until they reach military age. And then they cease to give a damn.
Yeah.
Was that Carla?
I probably so. I've heard that before. But yeah, it's hypocrisy, you know. Anything that's hypocritical, means there's a contradiction, which means there's an untruth. And there's a lot of wisdom in the truth will set you free. You know, the quote out of Atlas Shrugged, you know, A equals A, the truth knows no contradictions. If you find a contradiction, check your premise. You know, you're being hypocritical, people. Let's fix this. If you understand that nobody should be forced to be paying anybody to kill anybody, and that killing other people ain't right to begin with, you know, unless in self-defense, you know, there's always the self-defense part of it. And, you know, I my Quaker friends would argue with me with that, you know. It's like, no, we can't even do that. It's like, okay, that's your liberty to be that way, you know. But you do have the right, in my estimation, to defend your life and your liberty.
Another question on that Second Amendment. We're going to run out of time here very quickly, but if they take away a person's right to protect themselves and their families, and they claim that the police and the military are there to do that, I would highly suggest they read a book that was written several years ago. The author, who is now deceased, who wrote a book called Dial 911 and Die. And he documented every state in the 50 states, 57 if you like Obama, every state where people had called the police and been dead by the time the police got there, because they didn't have the right to defend themselves including one beautiful dispatcher one time who told a person who said, look, there's someone breaking in my house and I'm hiding in the closet and I've got a gun. And the dispatcher told him, said, well, put down the gun because the cops may be there in a minute. That actually happened. Well, anyway, Cal, it's been a great pleasure to be with you today. And I thank our friend Dave Scorpio, and I hope he comes along real well in his real estate venture to get back into the U.S. So any closing comments, my friend?
No, Mike, I just want to thank you once again for everything you've done in the cause of rightful liberty, you know, from your radio shows to your online courses that you've given out. I can't thank you enough or appreciate, you know, give enough accolades for the appreciation for everything you've done. You know, someday history will look back and it'll place you alongside the likes of Patrick Henry and Samuel Bryant. I just hope you enjoy that seat.
That's scary. Well, I tell you what, folks, if you really want to keep up, if you'd like to get some of those lessons for yourself, tune in on Telegram to Rebel Madman. Like to thank everyone for taking the opportunity to listen in to us today. And God bless everyone. And tune in on Sunday for Addicted to Your Own Destruction. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Listening to Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We talk about this.